Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now, we're turning back the clock to late summer in 1956 to give you a taste of a high country sheep muster before the advent of quad bikes and cell phones. We're on remote Bluff Station, a 22,000 plus hectare property in Marlborough. In the heat of February, every single sheep had to walk 90 kilometres to the woolshed for shearing. Bruce Petrie from the New Zealand Wool Board is the narrator of this story. He accompanied the muster that year when 4,000 ewes were moved down from the backcountry to Kekaringu on the coast by seven shepherds, a pack train and 40 dogs.
The radio telephone's been a great boon to the backcountry. Its invisible fingers have probed into the heart of the mountain chain and linked back station and front station for twice daily conferences when, a few years ago, the quickest way to get a message between the Bluff and Kekerang was to send a man on a two-day horse ride. As the sheep were being mustered in the backcountry, down at the home station at Kekerang, Jim Chafee, the station owner, sat in his office in front of the big radio telephone transmitter calling the Bluff homestead.
Kekerang calling Bluff, Kekerang calling Bluff, I'm up.
Hello, Kekerang. Yes, you're coming in all right here. Beautiful morning, no clouds, and...
Long and low slung, the Bluff Station homestead among its tall poplars looks like something out of an old print. It's got the appearance of great age and a certain workmanlike dignity about it. It's built of clay and tussock, a mixture known as cob. It clings close to the earth from which it was made, and its high, sharply sloping roof shows that the homestead was built to withstand heavy snows. It's occupied today by Mr. and Mrs. Roberts, the parents of the head shepherd, who cook and care for the backcountry lads. Les Roberts, the head shepherd, and his wife Edna live in another cob house, a little more modern, close by. And Edna, who 3 years ago was a town girl, and who's now tractor driver, radio telephone operator, and general chatelaine of the Bluff, told us how they managed their domestic affairs at the loneliest sheep station in New Zealand.
We live in cob buildings. One must be well over 100 year old, and the other comparatively recent for these times. But it's an interesting life. The homesteads are surrounded by trees, tall poplars, towering about 140 feet. You drop down then to the riverbank, and we have swimming. We have a tennis court built now, and, well, we just make our own fun as we go along. We do our own... We have to shift for ourselves everywhere. For a start, we make our own bread, all our cooking, of course, cakes, buns, anything like that. We live principally on mutton. For a change, of course, we go out on the hills, shoot pigs, deer, and occasional rabbits.
Before dawn next morning, the sheep would begin their long walk, moving in the cool hours of the day only, to the front country. Somewhere out on the run, the shepherds were holding them and preparing for the 6 days' drive over river, gorge, limestone face and high tussock land, which would end within sound of the Pacific breakers at Kekerang, within sight almost of Wellington City. How much wool was being walked out on this leisurely but obviously important occasion? The average flock of sheep in New Zealand's about 1,200. We'd be moving with a mob of 4,000 and only the ewe flock at that. What, in terms of bales of wool, would the harvest be?
These sheep that are being driven out tomorrow will yield approximately 170 odd bales of wool. We reckon on about 30 bales of wool to the 1,000 sheep. who run Wishia roughly about 13,000, which gives us about 390-400 barrels of wool.
Moving off with the pack train, we caught up with the shepherds at the first sheep camp, a corrugated iron shed beside the Clarence River. A mile or so away, the mob was held in a fenced paddock, about the only time you'll see a fence in the high country. 4,000 sheep would look a pretty large mob if it went along a city street. Here, on the slopes of a 10,000-foot mountain, it's no more significant than a sprinkling of salt on a wall-to-wall carpet. The horses graze alongside the sheep camp, and 40 dogs are tethered to the fence. Saddlery and gear are piled outside the hut, and there's the smell of roasting mutton and billy tea. We meet Les, Ron, Trevor, Jack, Ben and Bob, the shepherds, and the accents on youth. You realize that with different hats and more colorful shirts, you've met the authentic Wild West cowboy type, the man whose conversation concerns only dogs and horses, and for whom the world outside the high country doesn't exist except as a place to spend money in and to get out of in a hurry. Bob Middlemiss, a born high countryman, gave us an idea of what was going to happen on the sheep drive.
We have got to keep our sheep at a steady pace all the way on account of the stiff climbs, straight uphill and straight down the other sides of them. If we didn't, we would only land at our destination with half our flock. And the way we keep them going, we've got two men, one on each side, about 50 yards back from the lead. Then there's another man comes in on the bottom side, and then we have one or two men bringing up the tail. And that is the easiest way to keep a large mob on a steady pace all the way through. After we land in with the sheep to the front, they are shorn. Then they're dipped straight off the shears. Then they've got, on top of that, they've got the 56-mile trip back to the backcountry again. And it is the only way that we have of getting our sheep and our wool out of the backcountry.
From now on, we had only two ways of getting anywhere, on horse or on foot. And on the steep faces, it was always on foot. We moved at dawn through a rough country where there wasn't any foreground prettiness, a country of splendid vistas and magnificent distant scenery. Our pastoral symphony was fully orchestrated. Barking dogs, the high-pitched, queerly oriental call of the shepherds strung out along the flanks of the mob. Speaking waters, the occasional explosion as a piece of limestone, loosened by the noise of our passing, hurtled 1,000 feet down the slopes, and the creak and jingle of saddlery. The horse was the most important unit in our universe. As Jim Chaffee said,
high country shepherding of today, that is, can't be carried on today without, of course, the use of horses and dogs. The horses, we breed our own and supply the shepherds with two each, except that the odd shepherd has his own horse, and we run, we have to run still a pack team to pack our shepherds through from the front to the back and the back to the front, and there might be approximately 50 odd horses on the place.
What gear does the shepherd need for a trip like this? We travelled as a self-sufficient unit supplying our own needs, slaughtering our meat as we went. And every 2 days, the knives came out to reduce the flock to provide our meals and the dogs' meals too. Bob Middlemiss, who killed 3 sheep and skinned them while we were waiting for the mob to pour into the holding paddock at the Mead Hut, went into detail.
On this trip through here, each shepherd has got his own private bedroll with him, and that consists of a canvas sleeping bag, and then he has got 2 or 3 blankets. which he folds inside. And then he has got one or sometimes two sets of clothing. It depends on how long he is on the trip through. And they roll into quite a nice little roll to so as you can fit two each side of a pack horse. And on our hacks, we carry our oilskins, oilskin leggings, tucker bag, our little billy, a little bit of tea and sugar, and our midday meal. And all our dog chains, our shears, and I always carry a pair of pliers for any breakages in fences or anything like that. They come in very, very handy at times, especially around holding paddocks, or if you've got to take a horse over a fence or anything.
The most solitary figure on the sheep drive, the maid of all work, the universal provider, cook and bagman, is the packman. With his team of pack horses, he keeps to the pack track, which is often barely visible, sometimes washed away, and he moves from sheep camp to sheep camp, leaving after the mob has moved off with the dawn and arriving at the next camp sometimes 2 hours before the leaders of the mob appear over the skyline. Jack McDonald was our packy on the bluff trip, an old hand at the game and a skillful cook. Although we used horses for packing, Jack still had a soft spot for mules, which used to do the carrying work.
The one big advantage with mules, I found, was that they are cheaper to run because you do not have to shoe them, and they will live on less feed. And also, they are, from the packman's point of view, they are far better to load because they are not so high and you do not have to lift the heavy packs up so high. Horses, I like them very much. I really like horses better than mules, but the horses, I found them, if there's any feed about, they will stop and graze and you've got to keep on hunting them along. Whereas with the old mule, he will keep on going straight ahead from one camp to the other, and if the track is bad, he will carry on. It'd take a lot to stop a mule, because if the track was there before, he always thinks it should be still there.
Taking our larder from camp to camp was a fairly complicated business compared with, say, having lunch at a five-star hotel. All our food was carried in tucker boxes slung along across the horses, and if the pack train broke into a canter, which it sometimes unaccountably did, the hillsides rang to the mad jangling of knives and forks, mugs and tin plates, all bouncing about in the boxes.
The tucker boxes contain quite a mixed collection of foods, chiefly amongst them being bread, jam, cheese, sugar, tea, rice, butter, dried apples, and ready mixed plum puddings. Just got to mix them up in the basin and put them on to boil. Also, we take onions, plenty of potatoes. On the bluff trip, actually on the main muster, 80 pounds of potatoes are taken, and that just does the trip if we have a straight run. The food is cooked in a big pot called a camp oven, which is an iron pot with three legs and a lid on top which holds the steam in. You put the meat into this and hang it on the fire and keep a nice even heat, and it will cook meat just as good as anybody can in an electric oven or any other coal fire. In fact, a lot of people think it is a lot better. It's just a matter of taste. The meat on the journey is killed as we go along, just as we require it. Owing to the hot weather, it does not keep long, and if it's very hot, a sheep will only keep 2 days on the journey on account of not getting time to set properly. This meat, as we have no refrigerators, is just carried in a chaff bag on the side of the horse, And time we get to a camp, it is doesn't altogether look like meat, but still she eats all right, and the boys are hungry and enjoy it.
At night, all cats are grey, and to hungry men, meat is meat, whether it's been kept in a chaff sack or in a deep freeze. Anyway, by the time we'd reached the old Coverham homestead, now a sheep camp, and more than 100 years old, the butter and jam was getting a bit shop-soiled, and the bread was grey with fatigue. The sight of a bulldozed road, a prospect which pleased our packy, aroused guilty feelings that one's personal hygiene wasn't all that it might have been, and that perhaps one should think about doing one's hair or changing one's shirt. But really, it seemed to be too much bother. After all, we'd escaped from the tyranny of the bathroom for 5 days, and we weren't likely to meet anybody who was fastidious about washing. We were taking on a pastel shade, and doing all those things which our parents had spent a great deal of time warning us about, such as eating with our knives, not washing before breakfast, sleeping in our clothes, using other people's spoons, licking our plates, using bad language, in fact, pretty well all the things listed in the calendar of domestic misbehaviour.
That was a story about the muster in 1956 on Marlborough's Bluff Station. It was narrated by Bruce Petrie and recorded using one of the New Zealand Broadcasting Service's new portable tape recorders. It's an early example of a radio documentary using actuality recorded in the field. Our thanks to Ngā Taonga Sound and Vision, where you can find the full 58-minute documentary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.